So, what is, did anybody have? I noticed some of you actually wrote about this in the forum, and then I noticed a couple more that were addressing this book in the forum that came in today. I haven't had a chance to look at those. Anyone want to say anything about the Bester book? Now, this book is from 1953. Why would I use such an old book? Certainly, this is out of date by now, right? Well, in fact, and I don't think I've said this in this class before, and I'm going to talk more about this in the pedagogy class, but we have had, was it 5 or 6 education reform movements in the United States? They start out with, because in the wake of the demise of classical education, which is what we had before. So classical education rules until the first 2 decades of the 20th century, when you have the rise of both vocationalism and progressivism. Dewey is very confusing. I'm not sure that he was clear on his own thinking. And just this is a kindness to him. I hope he didn't have to read his own writing. It's pretty bad. Both of those things, the progressivism and the pragmatism, really ultimately come from Dewey, even though they're completely inconsistent with each other. Because one is an impulse to use the school to change society, which is progressivism, and the other is a desire to use schools to fit children to society. And in fact, in the first there's a first wave of progressivism in the early 1920s, and it comes through the schools. You can read about it in a couple chapters in To Kill a Mockingbird. I may have mentioned that, where Harper Lee is talking about her experience growing up in rural Alabama in the early 30s when it comes through the rural schools. And they're doing projects, and they're doing cooperative learning, and they're, you know, all those things that have become a part of progressivism ever since. But then there's another movement in the 1940s, in the mid-1940s. Progressivism comes into the 20s. Parents don't like it. Teachers don't like it. It gets thrown out of schools. It goes back into it goes into hibernation in the teachers' colleges and continues to grow. And then 25 years later, it comes out again, as I've said before, like the monster from Stephen King's It. It comes out again. And we have another big education reform in the mid 40s. And it's the same, except it has a more vocational emphasis. And at that point, Dewey came out and complained about that. He said that was not what his, now go look at his writing, looks to me like he's got vocationalism in there. But he says that it's the social reform aspect that we need to be doing. We don't need to be, you know, doing vocational training all that much. We want to change society. And so he complains about it, even though it too was referred to again as the second progressive education movement. And then that goes on into the early 50s, and they start throwing out academic subjects is what they do, because Dewey's idea is educating for democracy, making good citizens is basically how he kind of phrases that. And so one of the things they do with more intensity in the 50s, try to bring the curriculum into alignment with this progressivism. And they start throwing out academic subjects, and you go to these practical subjects. And this is when they bring in things like, although I don't know how many schools did it at that time, but like, you know, driver's education and sex education and all this stuff, to the point where Jacques Barzun said, you know, our schools are now about the business of making students at once sexually adept and flawless drivers of cars. That has become the new goal of schools. And so again, parents don't like this. Teachers don't like this. And they run it, you know, pitchforks and torches come out, you know, and they drive it out of the schools again back in to the teachers' colleges and the professional standards boards and the teachers' unions, all those groups that Bill Bennett, when he was Secretary of Education under Reagan, called the blob. He's called all those groups the blob. They were impervious to any kind. You could fight them, but every time you tried to fight them with something, it only grew stronger. Just if you ever actually watched the movie, The Blob. With Michael Landon was in The Blob, I believe. No, he was the werewolf. Never mind. talk about useless information. So then it's driven out of schools again. Then it comes back in the late 60s and early 70s with the new math, open classrooms, and it was just and the same old stuff that they had tried twice before and hadn't worked. And I should say that in the 50s, when with the second round of progressivism, which was also called the life adjustment movement, we were trying to adjust kids to life. That was another new purpose of schools. They called it the life adjustment movement. And you can read about this in Richard Hofstadter's book, Anti-Intellectualism in American Life. One of the great social historians, Hofstadter, he was a Pulitzer Prize winning historian. And he talks about, there's two chapters in there on the life adjustment movement in education and what that was all about, what they were doing. And it was very controversial in the 50s. This is when Rudolf Flesch writes his book, Why Johnny Can't Read. That's written in, I think, 55. That he's responding to them changing the way they're reading now. But then in the late 60s, early 70s, they've already really conquered reading. Now we're using whole language methodologies in reading by then. They attack math. Now, certainly you can't attack math. Math is objective. No. The new math comes along, and the new math is doing the same thing in math as they had been doing in language. They're trying to take more advanced concepts and drive them down into the lower grades too early, before they have mastered basic procedures in reading, before they've mastered sounding out words in math, before they have mastered arithmetical procedures. And so you get students who have trouble in math ever afterwards because they can't automatically add, subtract, multiply, and divide. In the same way that a student has a hard time reading because they can't sound out the letters, right? The progressives have always been opposed to basic skills. So then that happens. Again, it's very unpopular. Everyone makes fun of it. Another great book comes out by the great mathematician and writer Morris Klein, along with the physicist Richard Feynman, who he quotes in the book, and they make common cause with each other against this new math. And he comes out with the book Why Johnny Can't Add. Great little book. Really, it's the best thing I've seen. You can actually get that online for free if you look it up. It's an online text. But then that goes out, right? And then late 1980s, here comes outcomes-based education, which is this pragmatism and this progressivism. And then they add a layer, a top layer of high stakes testing. And so you get outcomes-based education, what I call outcomes, because we're going to take tests and that's going to be the test of whether this works. And we're going to take tests and see if they're doing better than they were before. And they're high stakes tests. They make it matter for the schools, not the individuals, but the schools. We had this we had the most intensive program like that in Kentucky. And we fought it back in the 90s. And then that goes out. It's unpopular again. And then it comes back again in the form of Common Core. Not necessarily Common Core as it was originally written. I'm going to allow for people to say that was conceived differently, but it doesn't matter. When textbook publishers get a hold of it, when the teachers' colleges get a hold of it, it gets turned back into the same old progressivist stuff again. And that's what happened. And that, of course, became very unpopular. And we don't really see it now, although it's all there. It's been, you know, all the teachers are trained in these new methodologies. Even though we don't have this big movement and the big advertising campaign for it, it's there. It's there. And so Bester is writing in 1953. He's writing in the tail end of the second round of this stuff. And if you go and read the best account of those first two reform movements, which is in Lawrence Kremen's book, The Transformation of the School. Now, Lawrence Kremen was at Columbia University. He was a legendary the historian of education. He wrote the great three-volume set of the history of education in America, and it won a Pulitzer Prize winner for that. So he was not like some big conservative guy or some big. He was just this great educator. And so, how many of you have heard of Diane Ravitch? Diane Ravitch. Okay, she was Kremen's student, his handpicked successor, and she's still a fairly prominent education voice. And so in that book, Kremen's account of what happened in the 50s with the life adjustment movement, the second round of progressivism, he says Arthur Bester was their mortal enemy. He was the guy they feared the most. So this book, all that was to say that this book is written by the guy who was the progressives' worst enemy. He got a lot of press. People listened to him. He had a big effect on this debate. So I just want you all who've read that book to know that that's who this guy is. He's a major dude, to borrow an expression from a Steely Dan song. Okay. All right, so let's see. Let me take Marion, because John, I'll call on you next. Marion, did you had your hand up?
Yeah, just there was a really fantastic podcast called Sold a Story on NPR that was about this trend in literacy teaching with the reading and writing workshop, the whole language, Fountas and Pinnell, Lucy Calkins. And it was fascinating because the narrative arc of the podcast was all about how all the schools got very, very enthusiastic about this reading writing workshop model, but there was no evidence to support that it worked. And I happened to be a middle school teacher in the middle of all that. And it did seem very lacking in basic foundational skills. It was all about making the child feel like a reader, making the child feel like a writer. And in the Lucy Calkins, to her credit, did finally admit that the approach was flawed and not backed up, and she's trying to revise her materials and make it more supported by evidence. And she was interviewed for the podcast, and she said, "Well, I didn't know that it had already been disproven. I just thought it sounded good. Doesn't it sound good to make the kids excited about being readers, to make the kids excited about being writers? But the thing is, they didn't have the skills to be strong readers. They didn't have the skills to be strong writers. And, you know, I know in Arthur Bester's book, he talked about how we should as an American public be saying of our public school system, what is coming out of all the money that's being put into it? What exactly are the children learning? How are they doing? And it seemed like that was the opposite of what was happening with these reading writing workshops. We were all getting excited about the idea of kids feeling like readers, without actually really critically asking the question, but are they becoming strong readers through this program? Have we proven it? Do we see it?
Right. And the thing is, the situation now, which is different from anything I have ever seen or read about, is that on the phonics issue, what the traditionalists have been saying all along is now as accepted as it's ever been. They are the people who have this whole language, whole word approach is as discredited as any theory in And it's not like it wasn't discredited, but if you go back and you read Rudolf Flesch's Why Johnny Can't Read, that is a polemical masterpiece. That is one of the best examples of argumentative prose you will ever find, because Flesch was an editor at the Saturday Evening Post, which was one of the big magazines of the time. And he wrote books on how to write and argue clearly. And I'll tell you, this is one of the best examples of it you'll ever see. And he has the evidence right in there. That was how long? 70 years ago? Over 70 years ago? It had already been laid out by Flesch in a book that was one of the best-selling books of all time, and it's still in print. And I'm thinking, I wish Flesch could have seen the day when, and it's happened really over the last 20 years, but more just in the last 5 or 10, where cognitive psychologists and cognitive linguists have gotten involved in this issue. And they have all said, folks, there is no issue here. Teaching letter sound correspondences is the only effective way to teach reading, period, end of story. And now we're calling it the science of reading. They can't bring themselves to use the word phonics. They're going to the science of reading, or what's the other one? Developmentally appropriate reading. They will use any word they can, because I think they just don't want to deal with the fact that they have been wrong for 70 years, actually more than 70, 80 years. They've been wrong. They have miseducated children year after year after year. It really is a scandal, but nobody's going to pay for it except for the children who had to go through it. It is a definitive, the studies that have come out on this really since the National Reading Panel in 2000, which found the same thing. I mean, here's a National Reading Panel. It gets started by Clinton. It was issued under the Bush administration. But what they did is they went and looked at every study on reading that had been done, every single one. And then they said, now, which one of these studies meets all the criteria for a good research study? Well, of course, research and education is terrible. They don't follow regular research criteria at all. It's always anecdotal. You know, all these studies you'll find in education journals, it's all like anecdote. Well, we went to this classroom and here's what happened, and there's no control group. There's a confusion of cause and effect. I mean, all the things you can do wrong, they do wrong all the time, and it's not replicated. That is the basic research criterion. Has this study been repeated by somebody other than the original researcher? And they only found like 50 studies out of 1,500 or something that even met the research criteria. And then they looked at those. I'm talking to the National Reading Panel. Then they looked at those, and all of them basically said that phonics is the best way to teach reading. We knew that in 2000 when they issued the report. We knew it really when Flesch was writing. And now that whole word strategy is about the most discredited theory of all time. I mean, everyone pretty much agrees about that. Now, my state of Kentucky, we were the last holdout. And so the legislature made them change it this year because Mississippi, you know, we're always telling ourselves in Kentucky, well, at least we're better than Mississippi in education. Well, Mississippi had abandoned this whole word stuff several years ago, and they were outperforming our kids in reading, and that was the final straw. Kentucky couldn't handle it anymore, because we got to be better than Mississippi. Yeah, so anyway, okay. Let's see, John, go ahead. Then we'll go to Debbie.
A couple quick things. First off, I noticed you mentioned the Crimmin book for the first couple of we're talking about the first couple of movements there, but is there a history that covers all five?
You know, there are not any real good ones, but the best ones are by Diane Ravitch. There's one called Left Behind. Well, it was something like Left Behind. That's the old series of novels. It's something like Education Left Behind or something like that. But you'll it'll be close enough to it, you'll see it. Diane okay. Ravitch, R-A-B-I-T-C-H. But again, Kremen student.
And then I find it interesting when we're mentioning Dewey and then the way they started getting rid of subjects later on, probably in that second movement, even more so. Dewey actually was a strong proponent of students learning music, way stronger of a proponent of students learning music than, say, Locke. John Locke was against it. He said it wasn't something that should be taught in the schools. It's not beneficial. Taking more of that Enlightenment approach. Now, the reason Dewey supported it was a totally different reason than a classical educator would, but still, he was right when it came to at least having music in the schools. Just kind of an interesting tidbit.
Yes, good. Somebody said Left Back is the name of the Ravitch.
Left Back. Thank left you. Back.
Yeah. Okay, Debbie.
Okay. I gotta ask, the teachers knew that phonics was best. They knew that this new math was not good. What was the purpose, the ultimate purpose, in making these changes that everybody knew would not work and was not best?
Okay. I wouldn't say that teachers knew it was bad, either reading or math. The teachers didn't know that because they were going to education college and the professors there were telling them that whole word strategies did work and that the new math did work without the research basis for it. So the teachers didn't know. You know, administrators are interesting creatures because they're kind of followers in terms of education theory and all that kind of thing. But the teachers were all indoctrinated in favor of those methods. That's the problem. And so all the people in who had anything to do with the education colleges were somebody mentions that Columbia controlled a lot of that narrative. They were just lied to. Quite honestly, and by people who were not good scientists, they were not good researchers, and again, they were covered up by these anecdotal studies, which didn't prove anything. All it proved is some teacher somewhere was able to teach reading with these bad methods. I mean, that can happen. Jacques Barzun talks about this. He says, you know, you can't. You find some teacher somewhere who's just one of these superstar teachers, right? I mean, there are teachers who are just so gifted naturally, partly because I think largely because of their personalities. They can get kids involved. They can get them doing things. But Barzun says you can't just take that and bottle it and have other teachers do that. They don't have those same natural abilities to do that. They're not as magnetic as a lot of other teachers. It's one of his three education fallacies, Barzun's three education fallacies. Don't ask me what the other ones because I can't remember, but they're in the book, one of the book we're using in the other class, Begin Here, it's called. Jacques Barzun, B-A-R-Z-U-N, Begin Here. But that's what I'm saying. You can't do that. And I've met really gifted teachers. And I've one I'm thinking of in particular who's fairly prominent in the classical education movement. I love her to death. But she will advise people to do the things that she's doing in her class, but if other people did them, it wouldn't work. It works because of her. And until you can clone her, then good luck with that, right? So, some teachers are good enough to make even bad methodologies work, but they're the extreme minority. So really, it did continue, Debbie, because all of the educational institutions were listening to these educational theorists, most of whom were postmodernists. There was a very strong postmodern flavor to the stuff that came out of education colleges. I had a good friend who's a major cognitive psychologist, and he was a professor here at the local school, the school here, one of the schools here in Kentucky, and he was in their education department, and he said, these people are just ideologues. They're just, and he was the most sober person I think I've ever met. You know, he would said, these people are just ideologues. They're a bunch of postmodernists. They talk about constructing meaning. Instead of learning how to sound out words, you're constructing meaning. And they had all this gobbledygook psychological stuff that they were using to prop up these methodologies that clearly didn't work. So does that somewhat answer your question, Debbie?
Yes, I was thinking just personally that, you know, is there a possibility that it was done purposefully knowing it wasn't the best?
Well, okay. I think there are people who are ideologues on certain things, and the evidence just is, evidence doesn't matter to them. I'm willing to stipulate that they were sincere in doing what they were doing. They really, I mean, it's like some religious beliefs, not of course my own, which are the product of your desire. It's what you'd like to see, and you don't really have an evidential basis for it. It's kind of like that. It's kind of, you know, an ideology is a secular religion. That's what it is. And so, so I think it was just sort of almost like a religious belief that they had, that they didn't have any evidence. It was a faith thing. And that's why they support, they just somehow, somebody convinced them of this. And they thought this was the best thing for children. It was the, you know, it was doing good for children and keeping them entertained and not making them, you know, have to go through all that painful spawning stuff. That's mean to children. I think they were sincere about that. They're particularly younger teachers of younger grades. You know, they care about children. And if somebody convinces them that it's mean and authoritarian to run children through phonics drills, and there were people who believed that, that was cruel, then you're not going to do that because you care for kids. And that's what you're told. You don't know any better. You haven't seen the evidence. You haven't read Why Johnny Can't Read. Nobody shows that to you in teachers' colleges. They keep that away from you. Probably don't even have it in the library. So that's, I think, the situation. I think there's a lot of indoctrination going. Marion?
I just wanted to respond to Debbie's question just based on my own experience. When I was a public school teacher, we were put in training by our district to run these reading writing workshops using what they called the balanced literacy approach. And we all just trusted that if the district was bringing in this $10,000 a day trainer, then this must be the best way to teach literacy to our kids. So on the teacher's end, and I was also a young teacher, maybe some of the older, more experienced ones saw through it more than I did, but we trusted our district. And I heard other teachers on this podcast I mentioned say the same thing. We thought if our district wanted us to do this, it must be the best option out there. And the other thing is that I think that we lost sight, or some people in education lost sight of the steps needed to reach the goal of helping children to become competent in my subject area, competent readers and writers. We were excited about that goal, but we lost sight of all the steps that really need to be taken to get there. You know, is it exciting to think about kids choosing their own books and getting excited about reading and writing their own original pieces? Yeah, it sounds great, but they can't just do it as children. They need to be taught a lot of skills first. And that's not as glamorous. You know, it's not as shiny. It's tedious. It's laborious. And it didn't feel like very much fun all of the time. So I think that all of those factors came into play.
Yeah. Okay. Now I want to get on to the book here. But John, did you have something else?
Yes, real quick, just building off the last two comments. I think that this kind of ties in with something that I mentioned last week with the research element. In the research doctoral world, those that go for professional doctorate and doctorates in education, those that are studying education, oftentimes their research is looked down upon because it's not good research. It's one of those things, they're not doing research the right way. And oftentimes it's leading people to, like you mentioned earlier, it's manipulating the teachers. And when these teachers are not trained to research well, when they don't know how to do their own research, or they don't have the time to do their own research, then they're not questioning what their administrators are telling them, or what the district is telling them, or what the government is telling them. If you're not questioning, then you have a problem. Where we know in good research programs, questioning is very, very, very important.
Yeah, and I'll just I'll mention, and I feel like I've said this before, but I'm in the middle of my speaking season, and so I can't remember what I've said to anybody. If I repeat myself, I apologize. But there, I don't know if I've mentioned that study that was done by the University of Connecticut researcher and a guy at Duke. I think it was Duke University, UConn, and Duke. I think is what it was. And it's on. You can actually probably look this up because I wrote it up for our schools division, and they published it. And that is that they did a study, because research in general is terrible. I mean, in the hard sciences, it's terrible. The book Rigor Mortis by Richard Harris, the NPR science reporter, he wrote this book on the state of research in biomedicine. It's terrible. It's terrible. It doesn't meet a lot of these criteria, and there's a guy by the name of John Ioannidis at Stanford University. His specialty is research, and he says, and he's got a study. It is the most downloaded study, academic study, the most downloaded academic. It's called "Why Most Research Is Wrong." Why most research is wrong. Okay, so it's terrible in the hard sciences. It's even worse in the social sciences. Like, and again, going back to that point I made before, you have to replicate the study. It has to be repeated to make sure you didn't make mistakes, okay, by two competent researchers. And you can't be the one doing it yourself if it's your own study. It has to be done by somebody else when you replicate it. So the replication criterion is the most basic criterion. If you don't pass that, we'll just stop right there, because you cannot rely on. So these two researchers, UConn, Duke University, they go and they look at all. This is a meta study, just like the National Reading Panel study. You look at all the research, not a sample. You look at all of it. This is one of the ways you do a meta study. It's a study of studies, right? So it's got to be totally objective. So they looked at all of the studies in several hundred education journals in this country. And I'm thinking, we have several hundred education journals in this country? That's too many. But they looked at it, all the studies, and they asked the question, has this study been replicated? Now, in psychology, a real soft science, it's 5%. Only 5% of studies in psychology are replicated to establish in the most basic way that it's reliable. Possibly. Got to do more than that, but that's the first thing. They looked at education studies, all of them. And you know how many education studies had been replicated? 0.13%. So literally 99.9-something% of all education studies are by definition unreliable. That's how much you can count on the reliability of education studies. It's the worst. And you know, people who are kind of close, maybe not in the professional education world, they all kind of know this. Somebody said, you know, these studies that come out of education, you just don't get good research in there. Everybody knows it. People look down on education departments. All the other, you talk to somebody in somewhere other part of the university, like particularly in the sciences, and they don't have any respect for education departments because of this kind of shoddy work. All right. Let me, Debbie, did you have something else? Okay, she took it. All right, that's fine. All right, so let's talk about Bester for a minute. So he starts out talking about, and he's talking a little bit about undergraduate in here and graduate, but I think I think his insights are very interesting. He starts out talking about the low expectations we have for schools. We have learned not to expect much from schools. And he kind of criticizes that. You know, we're too easy on schools. We let them get away with murder, and we think that's okay. It's just par for the course. It's just something you got to go through in life, I guess. So he kind of criticizes that, and I think he's right about that. But he says, and this is on page 13. I don't even know if my copy is going to be the same as everybody else's. But he says civilization requires widespread knowledge and skills, and he goes so far as to say in one part that everyone should have these skills. This is important for our civilization. If we don't have these things, then our own civilization is going to suffer. And I think we're seeing that now, because I think I said this before, we've gone through about three generations where we have not passed our culture down to the next generation. It hasn't been done. There are people who don't know why America is great. They don't know it. They've never been taught that. They don't know any history. They don't know our literature. They don't have any good idea of really what our culture even is. Okay. Then on page 14, he said, the school's main job is intellectual training. Intellectual training. This relates to his comment on page 18, talking about where he says, I think it's a really important one, that he makes a distinction between subject matter fields and disciplines. Did you get that? Because he's talking about the importance of intellectual training. And he's saying, just a big collection of facts doesn't do much for you. You have to know the basic aspects of how to read history and how to see history. And you need to learn something about the techniques, maybe, of just doing historical research and that sort of. But you have to learn how to think historically. To think historically, and just memorizing a bunch of facts about history is not history. It's not the discipline of history. You're asking questions about the motivations of the chief characters in there. You're asking them. You're learning things like, okay, and going back to say Aristotle, where Aristotle points out, look, there's a pattern of forms of government. You have a democracy. Democracies always devolve into anarchies, and anarchies into tyrannies, and tyrannies into aristocracies, and aristocracies into oligarchies, and oligarchies into democracies, and democracies into tyrannies, and tyrannies into aristocracies, and world without end. That's the cycle. That's the constant historical cycle. The ancient Greeks already had seen it. And that's why, right, you know, things that are going on right now with a whole several generations of people who don't even know our history and don't know why a republic is the best form of government. You know, I think the warning of Benjamin Franklin is very apropos here. You know, we've given you a republic if you can keep it. But we're forgetting why we did this. We didn't study the founders. We don't know why they chose a republic rather than a democracy. We do not live in a democracy. I have purged the word from my vocabulary when I talk about the United States, because it's misleading. It's not totally false, because we live in a democratic republic, but it's not primarily a democracy. It's primarily a republic. It takes different forms of government and melds them together into one that has the strengths of all and the weaknesses of none. Okay, that's what we have. And our students don't know this. Very few people, all the discussions we're having politically, nobody knows this. Well, if I had studied history and government better, if we had done that, maybe people would know, but we don't. We might recite some facts. So the interesting thing here is, that's kind of an anti-knowledge statement he's making. And when I go to teach my pedagogy class, I'm going to talk about the importance of knowledge. I'm going to quote E.D. Hirsch Jr., why knowledge matters. Is he, because E.D. Hirsch says you can't study anything unless you know basic facts about it. Now, is Bester contradicting that view, you think? I don't know if anybody's read E.D. Hirsch, but the cultural literacy guy. Are those two things, is he speaking out against knowledge per se? What is he doing? Colleen?
No, I don't think he is. I mean, again, if you get more into, and I'm sure kind of heading in this direction, he's focusing on what he terms, and you mentioned this, the disciplines. So on the different methods of thinking that encompass different subjects. So you have mathematical thinking. In the sciences, you have the, you know, the analytical experimentation. I forget exactly what he calls it. You know, in history, it's not just a collection of facts. It's looking at the evidence and thinking, you know, did this leader, did this figure in history make the right decision? So it's kind of analyzing decision points in history, not just, you know, a collection of facts. But then, so he goes through, I think he's got like six different areas of different disciplines, ways of thinking, you know, like, you know, an appreciation for art, you know, an understanding of culture, the values presented in literature. So that's like a different type of analysis. So he's got his six categories. But then when he talks about, you know, well, how do you get educated, for example, at the undergraduate level? In your main area, you're going to have this framework, you know, or this background of facts. But, you know, the first thing he wants to emphasize is the method of thinking. So, you know, to answer your question, he's not disregarding the facts, but I think he's placing them second beneath the method of thinking. So he says the method of thinking is more important. And then, you know, he's got his theory about major and minor, you know, parts of a degree, you know, where the facts are more important.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up in just a minute. Yeah. So and, here, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Just one final thought, and I'm trying to think of who was talking. Oh, Dorothy Sayers. She was actually talking about how, so in the elementary school, you teach the kids facts, one, because they have a good memory, and two, it becomes like a scaffold. Because they're not really ready for the higher level analysis, but you give them a little bit of a background, and then later on, you know, so they have an orientation to a certain, you know, a few facts to orient themselves, and then you start layering on the thinking. So, you know, I think depending upon how old you are, you know, facts are okay, but the most important thing is the critical thinking skills, which we talked about on our first week. What is that? But, you know, Bester is just looking at different areas of study and, you know, the different kinds of thinking required is most important.
Yeah, very good. And I will be talking about, I just touched on critical thinking in an earlier class, but I have a whole unit of that in my pedagogy class that we'll be talking about. Yeah, so I kind of formulated two statements that I think encapsulate what Bester's saying here. One is that the intellectual training is not only necessary, it's sufficient if you had that. But to have that, you also have to have the noble knowledge. The knowledge is less important than the intellectual training, but you can't do intellectual training without the knowledge. So in other words, knowledge and skills are the means of intellectual training, but not the ends. Okay, they're one of the things you have to have in order to have a good intellect is you have to know some stuff. You can't do it without any factual knowledge. But just having factual knowledge is not going to give you the intellectual training. You need it for the intellectual training, but it's not enough. Okay, does that hope that makes some sense? I think that's kind of what he's saying here. But yeah, this disciplines versus subject matter fields, which is where we have become, that's the way we came to think about these these different subjects is their subject matter fields instead of actual disciplines with their own tools for investigation and all that, that sort of thing. And then he talks about undergraduate general education and the importance of that versus graduate special education or innovate, you know, when he's talking about the importance of getting this broad general education and these basic, this basic intellectual training, which will then allow you to go on to do things like innovative research, you know, because what we want to do, we want to specialize early on. We want to get into, you know, doing a research paper early on before you've really mastered the intellectual training you need to do that. So we always want, you know, the tendency, the modern tendency is to discover new things rather than simply, because if you think about that, that's an extrinsic goal. To want to discover, let's say you want to, you want to do research in certain fields in colleges and universities, you know, some of that's the result of the fact that they got corporate donations to do research that would help whatever industry they're in, and that's great, but that's not an intrinsic, that's an extrinsic goal, not an the intrinsic goal of undergraduate education is not to develop some new product by discovering something you're doing in a research paper, you know. It's developing this. It's developing the intellect of the student. That's the goal of everything. And I think he would say this up to undergraduate education. He talked about the liberal arts college, right? I think I talked a little bit about that last week. So we got to remember, what is our K-12 and our undergraduate education for? It's to develop the minds and, if we're Christian educators, the souls of our students. That's the goal. It's not an extrinsic goal. It's an intrinsic goal. And then if you want to go and do research and uncover new things, that's probably best left for the graduate level. All right. Because it's going to be hard for you anyway. You're just not ready to go discover new things quite yet. You know, there's certain prerequisites to that. You got to master those first. He makes an interesting comment. This is jumping to chapter 11. When he talks about, and I guess that last one was too, about how American and British education, this is an interesting comparison contrast with Livingston. American and British education is focused on civic unity in a way that continental education is not. So there's a difference between what America and Britain are doing as opposed to, say, Germany and France and Italy and those countries. Over there, they're doing the innovation stuff, the research stuff, all that stuff. Whereas we have traditionally, and this has changed, I think, since 1953, we are more concerned, we have been more concerned about getting our students to be knowledgeable and intelligent. And we have done that by studying our own history and literature. And he makes some remark in there about how this may have something to do with the fact of political instability in those countries in a way that we have not seen that in America and England. We've had no big revolutions except for the very first one here in the United States. And there was the revolution in, what was it? I forget what, 16 something in England, but really what is the hallmark of England in particular has been stability, order. In America has experienced that too, partly because I think we're largely an English culture. We have, again, traditionally valued stability more and valued our passing on our own traditions from generation to generation. Again, all that's changed now. But that was a recipe for civic stability. Now since we haven't done this for at least probably three generations in this country, no wonder things seem to be coming apart at the seams because we have not passed our culture down, right? That's what he kind of intimates that Americans and British do in a way that European colleges and universities don't, because they're more, the research paper is the big deal, right? A big, you know, for a master's degree, it's a big thesis, which is equivalent almost to a dissertation over here. I took a master's degree at a university on that model, and I did a 180-page, not dissertation, but a thesis on G.K. Chesterton. That was quite a large project. That was the biggest part of your grade, is how you did on that piece of research. That's the European model. And then let's see what else was worthy of note here. He's talking about multiple ways of thinking, and this is something that Colleen was mentioning there, how he recommends that you have a major, whatever that is, a supporting field of some less important discipline, some discipline that's sort of parasitical upon another discipline, and then a minor in something exactly the opposite of what you're doing. So if you're doing a major in like literature, then you'd want your opposing one to be like physics or biology or something like that. I didn't remember reading that before in and I've used that book in class several times. I didn't remember that. What a great suggestion. And he says it gets past all this nonsense of the gen ed requirements, right? I mean that whole thing is so silly. I mean, it was required of me to take film studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, because of the gen ed requirements. I wanted to take more philosophy. I wanted to take some literature courses that were outside my major. I wanted film studies, all right? Well, they probably would have been better for them to make me take a science course, maybe. Now, I actually quite enjoyed my film studies course, but I didn't need to be paying exorbitant tuition to get that there. It would have been that my dad's money would have been better spent on something else. All right. So, but I love that idea of an opposing discipline to round you out in some way, in a way that these gen ed requirements really don't do. And then finally, the idea of the threshold of intellectual training, which was on page 171 in my book, which I thought, again, I don't remember having read this. I'm sure that I did for previous classes, but where he talks about this thing that when you try to generalize, you just don't go skimming across the surface of a bunch of subjects. He says that's not what you should do. You need to get in depth on your major discipline the discipline you're majoring in, but then do the opposing thing, but do it in a little depth, enough depth to where you're actually getting something out of it. You know, my example is I take a year of Spanish. Is that going to do me any good at all? I would be willing to say that's not going to do me any good at all. I might as well have just not done it at all. I'm going to get this little smattering of stuff, but if I don't use it, if I'm not in some Spanish speaking community, I'm just going to forget it all. I had Spanish from kindergarten through 12th grade about 7 times. This lady would come. I was in private schools for most of that. And this lady would come. She taught Spanish, and she'd come in the first grade, and we'd start learning Spanish. And then we wouldn't see her for a year or two. And then she'd come back again, and we'd learn Spanish again. Usually, I think the same stuff we learned the first time, because we'd forgotten it, because we hadn't done it. And then she left again. And then a couple of years later, she came back. It was a waste of time, because unless you get to the point of a certain point in a subject, you're just going to forget it all. You've got to get to the point, he calls it this threshold of intellectual training, where it's something that will benefit you and you'll retain it. But this course skimming stuff does not work. And so I thought that was a really, really great point. I mean, and even now I will say I did 2 years of Spanish with a very good Spanish teacher that taught it using the grammar-based approach. I felt like I benefited, for no other reason than I learned some grammar in there. My German class, it was taught using, even the German is a more organized, inflected language. It was taught conversationally. And so I took 2 years of it. I don't know anything. I don't know any German. I did retain a little bit of Spanish because it was taught in this grammar-based way. And Spanish is more common, obviously, in Southern California here. So you got to take enough of a subject to where you meet this threshold, he calls it, where you actually gain something permanent from it. Okay. Does that make sense to everybody? I thought that was a great, great point of this. All right. John.
So real quick, I'm wondering if one of the changes in the last three generations that have led American schools, universities, as well as schools and universities in the UK to leave kind of this more traditional approach, focusing on American history, on Western history, on government, these things, is the politically correct tendency to say that, oh, the old way of doing things is elitist, so we need to leave that behind. We can't, it's just as important that we learn about this tribe in Africa or something, instead of learning, taking an extra course in US history or something like that. I'm wondering if the politically correct tendencies of the universities, as well as our K through 12 schools, is what's leading to this kind of, one of the things that's leading to this pressure against what, even during Bester's time, our schools
Well, were doing better. Yeah, because I think they violate something else that Bester says here. He says there are some disciplines that are more important than others. I mean, the people you're talking about don't believe that any particular discipline is any important than others. I think part of our problem in academia and the sort of postmodernist attitude there is that you don't believe in hierarchies. So if you don't believe in hierarchies, you can't believe that one discipline is better than the other, because that's a hierarchy, and they're against all hierarchies. Thank you, Foucault, and a few other people. I mean, that's a Derrida, I think, too. So once you make that ideological commitment that there are no hierarchies, then you can't make decisions on any rational basis anymore. Film studies is just as good as introduction to physics. Right. So. Now on to, unless anyone has any other questions on this, I really like Bester. It's an old book, but he's speaking to today in an ironic kind of way. So we're gonna move to the Greek way, but Debbie, go ahead. Looks like you have a question.
I was just gonna say that I think it is political. I really do. I highlighted a lot of things in the book, but on page 12 in the second chapter, where he says, in the first place, a republican system of government requires citizens who are highly literate, accurately informed, and rigorously trained in the processes of rational and critical thought. If the schools fail to raise up a nation of men and women equipped with these qualities of mind, then self-government is in danger of collapse through their sheer inability of its electorate to grapple intelligently with the complex problems in science, economics, politics, international relations that constantly come up for public decision. So I believe it is political, because it seems to me that there is an intentional, that's kind of goes with what I was asking you earlier about, you know, why for so long have we kept these teaching practices that we know don't work? I mean, the parents don't know they work. The teachers know they don't work. The parents know they don't work. The students know they don't work. So, you know, and a lot of it I know has to do with money. People are making money, like Fontas and Pinnell, you know, they're making a lot of money. Somebody's getting rich off of that, and it's not helping our students. But, you know, I read that and immediately it came to mind about the purposeful dumbing down of American students. Because, you know, if they do not get the education that they should get, or that, you know, that classical education that I wish I had, you know, they're not going to be able to make intelligent decisions. And, you know, the government is going to be able to rule as they will, and people are just going to be sheep. So I think it is very political.
Well, I think there are definitely political aspects of this, but I think I guess I prefer the word ideological, although I think probably I'm using that the same way you're using political. But I do think there are people, and they are the people, if you go to the source of some of these things, that are the extreme ideologues. Whereas those ideologues, I think, convince other people who don't share their ideology about something. Because most people aren't thinking about this real hard. They're getting their ideas downstream. They don't understand the ideological roots of a lot of this stuff. It's just somebody convinces them of it. I mean, I think that's even true of the reading and the math. I think there are ideological roots to that. But most of the teachers, I would be willing to say most of the people who were doing the training for these methods that didn't work really believed it. I think the people who taught them believed it because they had a hard ideology against it, which was impervious to evidence. The evidence didn't matter. So I would say it's more ideology than politics. I mean, it's not going to win anybody in office, you know, in that sense. But I think there are ideological origins to all of this. And all you can, you know, and they go back a long way. They, you know, the kinds of particularly postmodern thinkers that have come to the fore in the 20th century in particular, I think that a lot of their ideas, we're getting the downstream effects from those things. And I don't know that, I don't know how insincere those people are, but I do think they're wrong, and that their mistaken assumptions make everything that they propose suspect. So I would say ideology. I think I know what you mean by political. I don't know that. I guess I have a hard time trying to believe that somebody really wants to turn this country upside down and destroy everything. Now, I'm sure there are some nihilists out there, or maybe some unconscious nihilists. There's a lot more of those. That's really what postmodernists are, is unconscious nihilists. I think they're just a lot of them are not necessarily intentionally trying to destroy them. They've just had the wool pulled over their eyes by somebody they thought was real smart and they ought to listen to. There's arguments for both sides of that. Somebody mentioned John Taylor Gatto. Yeah, that's he's done a lot of stuff there. Okay, so let's talk about the Greek way. We just have about 25 minutes here. I tell you what, this book, I really like this book a lot. Now, when we get into this kind of stuff, and we're gonna get more and more into this kind of stuff toward the end of the course about the cultures of Greece and Rome, and we're going to be reading authors who don't necessarily have any religious motivation for what they're saying. I don't know if Edith Hamilton is a Christian. I don't know if Jeffrey Hart. If he is, there's some things I disagree with him on. We got another. I don't know where Livingston is on that issue. But I think that what we have to realize is, and because the case they're going to make is that there is value to Greek culture and there is value to Roman culture. And it's a value that comes from the fact that even though they were not privy to any kind of divine revelation, they were human beings. And they were created by God, and so they were able to see things. I mean, God puts in us, whatever our particular religious beliefs, the ability to see truths. And so the argument is going to be made that the Greeks primarily and the Romans secondarily saw things that were true. They discovered truths. And the Greeks in particular were very good at this. Something happened in Greece. You know, she calls it in this book, the Greek miracle. Something happened so that you had thinkers in that, in Greek culture in particular, who were able to see the true and the good and the beautiful, not in its ultimate manifestation in God necessarily, but they were seeing the hints of it. And so what they did was extremely valuable. We're going to talk about more about that issue, about these issues in a later course. But I think Edith Hamilton is an extremely wise person. And she's a beautiful writer, I think, too. So this book, The Greek Way, is I think, really a little masterpiece. Now, she also wrote a book called The Roman Way. That's also very good. It's not quite as good as this, I don't think, but it's very good. She is able to capture the Roman character as well as she here captures the Greek character and the Greek outlook on life, right? And so she starts out in that chapter, East and West, and talking about the Greek culture and its influence. Because one thing that is undeniable is that we are the ideological children of the Greeks, that everything follows from the Greeks in Western society. Because you have the Greeks, you have the taking of Greek culture to the entire known world when Alexander takes very consciously the Greek culture. Why would Alexander, who's a Macedonian, he's not an ethnic Greek, he's a Macedonian. But he's got a really pretty good tutor, Aristotle. Aristotle is Alexander the Great's tutor. Okay, I wonder what he charged. I'm just curious. So he imbibed the Greek culture. He loved the Greek culture in a way that his father, he was still pretty much a barbarian, did not. And so when he goes and conquers the world, he carries a copy of Homer's Iliad and sleeps with it under his pillow. He had memorized long passages from Homer. And where they went, they brought their culture with them very intentionally. And so he takes over everything west of him, the Middle East, Egypt, Northern Africa, all the way to India. That's a long way, okay? That's when his soldiers finally rebel and say, we want to go home now. So he takes it to all these places. And a little curiosity here. Did anyone see the little blow up about the new Cleopatra movie that they made with a black woman as Cleopatra under the claim that Cleopatra was black? Okay, whatever. But all these people came out of the woodwork and say, excuse me, she was not in any way black. Now, Egypt's in Africa. So they just, I guess some people assume she, no. She was a, what's the Roman general? She was a Ptolemy. She was a Greek. It's because when Alexander died, after he had conquered everything, I think he was in Babylon when he died. And he, you know, the famous story is he, you know, takes his ring as he's dying on his deathbed, and four or five generals are standing around his bed, and he takes his ring and he drops it to the floor and he says, to the strongest. That's probably a myth, but maybe it's based on some historical fact, But what happens is the empire gets split up between his generals. And the general who took over Egypt was Ptolemy. And Cleopatra was, even in the representations of her in the Egyptian art, she was white. And she was, because she was a Greek. She was a Greek. She was the descendant of Ptolemy. And so I just thought that was interesting because there was this debate about something that had to do with the ancient world. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Why was I even mentioning that? Oh, yeah, because Alexander, because he takes the Greek culture to the world. And so everything from there, the Romans take over the Greeks. And the Romans take over the Greeks militarily, but in many ways, not always, in many ways, the Romans are defeated by the Greeks culturally. Because the Romans respected Greek culture. They knew that the Greek culture was higher than theirs. And that's why they sent their children to Greece to be educated to boarding schools during the Roman Empire. And that's why they hired Greek tutors to teach their kids. That's why in many Roman homes, they spoke Greek like the Russians did French during the Imperial Russia. They many times spoke French in the homes when there was something that could be better said in French. They knew French. That was the same situation with Greece and Rome. So Rome imbibes a lot of the Greek culture, and it all gets passed along down through the ages when, you know, things revive in the Renaissance, pronounced a little differently to distinguish it from the Renaissance later on, but in the 8th century, with Carolingian learning revival, they get all these Latin and Greek texts back in the West. They hadn't seen them. They'd been in Constantinople in the Eastern Empire, which was hard to get to from the Latin West. They were in Syria and Lebanon at monasteries there. All these manuscripts from all the ancient writers. The Muslims took them as they conquered all the way up into Spain, and so they had some of the manuscripts in Arabic in Spain, and they got translated into Latin there. And we rediscovered Western learning because of all this. But we focused on the works of the Greeks and the Romans. They were the ones who knew stuff. And in learning, you know, came close to being completely extinguished. That's the interesting thing about this. It almost died. We would not be here if it weren't for a bunch of Irish monks, you know, copying and recopying these manuscripts for hundreds of years before they were rediscovered. So it says, she's talking here, she says, a new civilization had arisen in Athens, unlike all that had gone before. She talks in here about the Greek miracle. Something happened. There was nothing like it before. And then in the course of one or two generations, boom, there it is in full flower. That's such an interesting thing to think about. How did that happen? I mean, in philosophy, in art, in drama, all of a sudden, here it is, boom, in statuary, again, drama. We have these plays that still are the greatest. To this day, we have not approximated the greatness of some of Aeschylus's dramas, I think. It says, it is worth our while, page 16, in the confusions and bewilderments of the present, to consider the way by which the Greeks arrived at the clarity of their thought and the affirmation of their art. And on that next page, she says, though the outside of human life changes much, the inside changes little. And the lesson book we cannot graduate from is human experience. Great literature, past or present, is the expression of great knowledge of the human heart. Great art is the expression of a solution to the conflict between the demands of the world without and that within. And in the wisdom of either, there would seem to be small progress, right? But then along come the Greeks. Middle of page 17. There is no sculpture comparable to theirs. No buildings ever more beautiful. No writing's superior. Prose, always late of development, they had time only to touch upon, but they left masterpieces. History has yet to find a greater exponent than Thucydides. I read Thucydides, Peloponnesian War, and I'm thinking, here he is writing in the 5th century BC, maybe it's 4th or 5th century BC, and he's talking about his sources and where he got things from. And he's talking about all this stuff that modern historians write about, but this is 2,500 years ago, and this guy's writing like a modern historian. It's amazing. Outside of the Bible, there is no poetical prose that can touch Plato. In poetry, they are all but supreme. No epic is to be mentioned with Homer. No odes to be set besides Pindar. Of the four masters of the tragic stage, three are Greek. Little is left of all this wealth of great art. We have only the ruin of what was. The world has had no more than that for well on to 2,000 years. Yet these few remains of the mighty structure have been a challenge and an incitement to men ever since, and they are among our possessions today, which we value as most precious. That is a pretty amazing thought. It's something to ponder. And then she actually uses the term Greek miracle to consider, she says, the radiant bloom of Greek genius as having no root in any soil that we can give an account of. It seems to come ex nihilo, from nothing. Nobody can explain this historically, right? Because one of those disciplines that Bester talks about in history is trying to derive how did something develop out of some historical antecedent. Right? That's what we're supposed to do. There was no historical antecedent. And you read some of these writers, Theodore Mommsen mentions this. Will Durant, who I really love Will Durant. I think he calls it the life of Greece is his big one. He talks about this too. Nobody can make any sense of it. Where this came from, seemingly out of nowhere. And he contrasts it with the East, the West, the Greeks are representative of the West. And he contrasts it to the East. He said the spirit of the East never changes. She says it has persisted down from the ancient world through thousands of years, never changing in any essential. Now, she's writing in the early 20th century, so she hasn't seen a lot of the westernization of Asia. Okay, we see that now. They've been westernized, highly westernized. But that is not as evident when she's writing here. She said, but the spirit that informs it is the spirit of the East that never changes, is remain the same through all the ages down from the antique world, forever aloof from all that is modern. This state and this spirit were alien to the Greeks. This Eastern thought was alien to the Greeks. None of the great civilizations that preceded them and surrounded them served as a model. With them, something completely new came into the world. They were the first Westerners, the spirit of the West, the modern spirit. The modern spirit is a Greek discovery, and the place of the Greeks is in the modern world. And first she contrasts it with Rome, right? Now, Rome is actually geographically to the west, but in her book, The Roman Way, she talks about Rome as a revitalization of Eastern Oriental ideals. Is a kind of resuscitation of that. The same cannot be said of Rome. Many things there pointed back to the old world and away to the East. And with the emperors who were gods and fed a brutalized people full of horrors as their dearest form of amusement, the ancient and the original and ancient and oriental state had a true revival. Rome was a revival of Eastern culture and thought. Common sense men of affairs were its product, to whom the cogitations of Eastern sages ever seemed the idlest nonsense. "What is truth?" said Pilate scornfully. He was a Roman, scornfully. But it was equally far removed from the Greek spirit. Greek thought, science, mathematics, philosophy, the eager investigation into the nature of the world and the ways of the world, which was the distinguishing mark of Greece, came to an end for many a century when the leadership passed from Greece to Rome. Athens and Rome had little in common. That which distinguishes the modern world from the ancient, and that which divides the West from the East, is the supremacy of mind in the affairs of men. And this came to birth in Greece and lived in Greece alone of all the ancient world. The Greeks were the first intellectualists. In a world where the irrational had played the chief role, they came forward as the protagonists of the mind. She goes on to say that, you know, the world we live in seems to us a reasonable and comprehensible place. But what brings about this attitude is the fact that of all the powers we are endowed with, we are making use preeminently of reason. That is a Greek thing. That comes from the Greeks and the Greeks only. And when Greek culture declines, so does that tradition, right? Even things like philosophy, right? Because you have Plato and you have Aristotle, and they're very theoretical. But you get to Rome, what was the most popular school of philosophy in Rome? Anyone know? The most popular philosophy in Rome, Stoicism, which does have Greek roots. But the reason it's popular in Rome is because Stoicism is very practical. It's not theoretical. You know, Plato, you know, it's practical. What is your everyday ethics, right? If you are faced with the choice between right and wrong, which one do you do? That's the kind of question a Stoic asks. That's not the kind of question with Plato. It's what is the good? What is the true? It's very theoretical. That's the Greek temperament as opposed to the Roman temperament. Hamilton points out, reason is not a common thing in history. Most of history is very irrational. Most people in history have been very irrational. Most thinkers in history have been irrational. He also contrasts it with Egypt. He said, for a very brief period in Greece, East and West met. The bias toward the rational that was to distinguish the West and the deep spiritual inheritance of the East were united. The full effect of this meaning, the immense stimulus to creative activity, can be best realized by considering what had happened before Greece. What happens, that is, when there is a great spiritual force with the mind held in abeyance. This is to be seen most clearly in Egypt. He says, in Egypt, the center of interest was the dead. The dead. Death was a foremost preoccupation. It is an extraordinary circumstance, she says, which could be made credible by nothing less considerable than the immense mass of Egyptian art centered on the dead. Their art is centered on that. But there were two causes, she said, that were causing this. The first was human misery. I mean, we don't have, I don't think, any conception of how miserable the lives of many of the poor were in the ancient world, okay? We have programs for all that now, right? We give out all kinds of money for everything, every problem everyone has. But she says there was nothing so cheap as human life in Egypt and in Nineveh, and nothing more cheap in India and China today. Again, she's writing at the beginning of the 20th century. The lives and fortunes of all were completely dependent upon the whims of a monarch whose only law was his own wish. All right. Very different from Greece, where law was seen as supreme. And that certain amount of that in Rome as well, but they got that from the Greeks. And she says, she talks about the Egyptian priests. But the Egyptian priests, all they kept, all they knew, she said, must be kept jealously within the organization. To teach the people so that they would begin to think for themselves would be to destroy the surest prop of their power. That's how the priesthood kept in power, was the fact that they had all the knowledge and learning, which is interesting when it comes to something like Moses. In fact, there's a children's history book by G.A. Henty called The Cat of Bubastes. And there's some historical justification for this, where he talks about Moses, who was being raised by a priest. Moses had access to all that, to that knowledge of the priests, in a way, because he was part of the aristocracy, for one thing. And he apparently had some, so he actually knew some things that the priests knew, which would have been very unusual. The priesthood rested on ignorance of the people, right? The power of the priest depended upon the darkness of the mystery. It was mysterious to everybody else. Only the priests knew things. And he also talks about India. She says, in India for centuries, the leader of thought to the East, ages long since, the world of the reason and the world of the spirit were divorced. And the universe handed over to the latter, the world of the spirit. And she goes into the whole thing about art. Why art is the way it is in India, and why art is the way it is in Greece, and why they're so utterly different. Because the Greeks are trying to portray reality at its most fundamental level, whereas Indian religion, which is Hindu, has affected their art, where they're not concerned about realism. They believe the world is Maya, illusion. And so their art, as a result, their art is very, it's not trying to portray reality. That's illusion. And it becomes, she talks about two kinds of art. There's some of the religious art. You know, you've seen, you know, the statues with six arms and, you know, several legs and all this stuff. And also it becomes very decorative. You know, now I'm looking at this Persian rug at my feet here. This does not represent reality of anything. It's simply decorative. And so she has a very interesting analysis of why Indian art is that way, which is really kind of fascinating. She also talks about how the Greeks loved life in a way that the Egyptians never did. She says, and I had never thought of this before, but she says, the Greeks were the first people to play. Isn't that an interesting thing? They were the first people to play. And so, me too many. They were first people to play. They had the Olympic Games. And everyone put down their weapons. If they were fighting, they put down their weapons and they go to the games. This was how important this stuff was for them, wrestling and all this stuff. And what else did they do at the at these games? What else did they compete in? Anyone know? Not just physical sports. What else did they compete in? John?
Music, poetry, dance.
Right, right. So you had the great playwrights like Aeschylus and Sophocles, Euripides, the tragedians. They competed. You could win a medal for a really great play. Kind of wish they'd do that now, right? But they, you know, maybe that wouldn't be a good thing. It might not be very good. But yeah, that's how a lot of these people. I mean, we have a record actually of how many awards that some of these Greek playwrights won at the different games. That the main one was the Olympian Games, but there were others like that. They just put everything down, and they would just play, or watch sports or whatever. They invented comedy. Another thing she pointed out. Imagine that. Imagine a world without comedy. Apparently, the ancient world was not very funny. But the Greeks invent comedy. She talks about the birth of freedom. She talks about the role of, she talked about how Greeks are the first scientists. They're the first people who look at nature and try to find out why things are the way they are. Nobody else even asks those questions, but the Greeks do. They systematized. They were intellectuals. They were systematizing. They were giving you the reasons for why things were the way they were. And they took, as she points out in here, this childish delight in learning. That spirit of play extended itself into the life of the mind, very interestingly enough. So I don't have time to go into much more of this, but there's an interesting, where is it here? She talks about, hang on. There's a section here where she talks about when Paul, she's talking about the Mars Hill discourse. I'm trying to find where you know Paul is appealing to some of these characteristics of the Greeks in his speech on Mars Hill, and I'm not finding that.
It's 35 in my book. Page 35 in my book. I didn't mean to interrupt. I tried the chat.
Good. No, I'm not looking at. You know what? Your book must be different from mine because I'm not seeing it there. Is it chapter 2? I'm guessing.
Yes, it's in Mind and Spirit. Is it something you just want me to read out loud for you?
Yeah. Do you have it? Do you have it? Is it in a identifiable section there?
So let's see.
Oh no, here it is. I'm sorry. So it's on page 50 of mine.
Okay.
It's on page 50 of mine. So
okay.
So he says, ye men of Athens, said Paul and the Areopagus. Let me see if there's a preface to that. So she's talking about how spirituality inevitably brings to our mind religion. Greek religion is known to us chiefly or only as a collection of fairy tales, by no means always edifying. This is to belie the immense hold the Greeks had on things spiritual. Now, the priests had very little power. The priests were just there to do the rites, pretty much, and that's it. They had very little to do with the life of the mind and all that. There was very little connection between the Greek religion and Greek things intellectual, all right, philosophy and all those things. It would have been impossible for the nation that produced the art and poetry of Greece to have a permanently superficial view of religion, just as it would have been impossible for them not to use their minds on Homer's gods and goddesses. Those charming stories, which came down from a time when men had a firsthand knowledge of nature, now forever lost, were never, it is true, anathematized with book and bell and public recantation. That was not the Greek way. They loved them and their fancy played with them, but they found their way through them to what underlies all religion, East and West. And she's got a quote from Aeschylus in here. And then, ye men of Athens, said St. Paul on the Areopagus, I perceive that in all things ye are too superstitious. But the superstition word, in dread of the divine power. She says that word superstitious, that Paul's accusing the Greeks of, could mean in dread of the divine power, a meaning borne out by the reason Paul gives for his use of it. For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, I found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. The words carry us far away from the gay company of the Olympians. They go back to the poet who had written, Paul's quoting a Greek poet here. They go back to the poet who had written, through thick and shadowed forest stretched the pathways of his purpose beyond our power to search out. It's like Paul is pointing out that you know, all your intellectual stuff you have. And I almost wonder if he means to say, why haven't you used it more on the religious issue? Right. Of all that you have, you are here admitting what you don't know about God. Move it to the unknown God. That's an interesting thing to have we have the tomb of the unknown soldier. And it's just because we don't know his name. But a tomb to an unknown God, that's an interesting thing, isn't it? That altar to the unknown God who is past our power to search out is almost if the Greeks were admitting that their power was limited. Could have been raised only by men who had gone beneath the pleasant surface of comfortable orthodoxies and easy certainties. I just thought that is very interesting that the Greeks have this shrine or whatever it is, it's monument to an unknown God. It's like they knew that there was one there, but they couldn't say anything about it because they knew their human reason was limited, as much as they loved to practice it, that it was limited. They couldn't quite reach there. And then Paul basically says, it's that God I'm proclaiming to you. I think that's pretty, that event to me is quite astounding. It's Paul confronting Greek culture right there and saying, the one you want to worship but can't because you don't know what it is, I am proclaiming to you right now. That had to have taken them aback. And of course, the problem, and I was trying to find, there was another thing in here. Oh, it's at the end of that same chapter. It's at the end of the chapter East and West in Art, where he's talking about Greek art and how simple their architecture was, right? Their temples were very simple. And I thought, that's weird, because I always thought of like these Christian cathedrals, and we'll wrap up here in a minute. These Christian cathedrals, some of them are, you know, I always thought that that goes back to the Greeks, but some of these Christian cathedrals are really ornate. The thing that the Greeks had the most problem with, apparently on Mars Hill also, is this idea that God could be incarnate. That did not compute with the Greeks. Partly it's because of Plato's idea of these perfect forms being in this heavenly realm, away from the worldly concrete things, which are imperfect. We live in a place of imperfection. So how could God take on a form that was imperfect? You could see why they would have problems with that. But Christian art takes what's good of the Greeks, but yet we have this, we are trying to reach up to God, but also God has reached down to us. So obviously that's going to affect the art. There's got to be some meeting between God and man, which we see in Christ, right? So this ending of this chapter was very interesting to me, where she says, to the Greek architect, man was master of the world. His mind could understand its laws. His spirit could discover its beauty. The Gothic cathedral was raised in awe and reverence to Almighty God, the expression of the aspirations of the lowly. We praise thee, O God, we who are as nothing save in our power to praise thee. The Parthenon was raised in triumph to express the beauty and the power and the splendor of man. Wonders are there many, none more wonderful than man. His the might that crosses seas swept white by storm winds. He the master of the beast lurking in the wild hills. His is speech and windswift thought. Divinity was seen, back to Hamilton again, divinity was seen incarnate, though perfected mortality, through perfected mortality, man was immortal. All they had for man to be immortal was perfected humanity. It's only one way. Whereas the Christian turns that around, and things are coming now from above. We are not sufficient in the way the Greeks thought man was. But even then, I mean, the Greeks are kind of scared of death. They don't have any, the Romans apparently had some higher aspirations for death, but the Greeks didn't. You wonder how they could be so happy and play so much knowing, not knowing what came after and fearing it. The Greek accounts of afterlife are not good. When you read the Iliad and the Odyssey, it's not clear where you even go after life is over. Whereas in Christianity, you have a conception of that. You have a revelation to you of what your fate is eternally. So I'm just going to leave it there. Any comments on that before we go? I didn't really do Hamilton justice there, but I love those, particularly those first three chapters of this book. It's really, really good stuff. She really has a very interesting angle on the Greeks, and then later in her other book on the Roman way of the Romans.